So let's look at it together. Let's think about this a bit. If I put out a menu with various things on it, you might have a situation. Why are you laughing? What have I said? Okay, fair enough. No, fair enough, fair enough. If I put a menu out, if I put various things on there, if I put vol-au-vents, right? Does anybody know what a vol-au-vent is? A couple of vol. Some people, they go vol-au-vent, they go, no, that's just not for me, right? Okay? Serve up tripe, okay? And there'll be somebody else, and they're going, yeah, that's my cup of tea. Fried Mars bars or whatever it is. You know, everybody's, different foods have a kind of an attraction to people, right? Different groups of people, they have their food. You know, you go to a certain party and there's a certain kind of food, and it sort of tells you a lot about the group of people that are there. Vol-au-vents, you've got an idea of the kind of, makes associations. Food makes associations, right? And it's not surprising that people say things like, you are what you eat. You are what you eat. I mean, obviously, you're not what you eat, but you're kind of, it's not just saying that it physically affects you, the kind of diet that you have, but you can tell different people and the kind of diets they have. You can tell physically it affects people, their diets. But it also, it's the culture, isn't it? It's your culture. Food and culture run together very, very closely. And I think sometimes you could play a game if you had a list of foods and you had a list of people, you had a game of trying to match the person to the food. You know, you could play, you are, and you would try and match people up. I'm not quite sure what's going on with the mic. It's coming in and out, isn't it? Hmm? Want to hit the cable? Okay. Let's try that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that. I suppose what I'm saying is that food can be like putting down a marker. This is our food. You know, you have British cuisine, French cuisine, right? It stands out, doesn't it? It's distinctive. Italian food, Japanese food, Korean food. It's distinctive. People mark out their culture by the food that they prepare. It's a big thing. People do it by the clothes that they wear. It's perhaps less prominent in these days. There's a lot much more homogenous kind of a style of dress. You get people dressing the way we're sort of dressing all around the world now, more and more so, T-shirt, pair of jeans. There's a time when you could go from tribe to tribe or region to region, and you could tell the people in the group by their costumes and the people marking out, saying, this is part of my identity, right? The way you wear your hair. I mean, I grew up in a time when, you know, it was the punks were coming up. You know, so, and then there was the rockers or whatever and stuff like that. So some people had their long hair, other people shaved their hair off, some people had spikes and all the rest of it. But you could tell where people were associating by the cut of their hair, by the way they wore their hair. People defined, said, this is my culture, this is my people. I've just come back from Jerusalem, as you know. Walking around Jerusalem, you could play a game just by the cut of the beard, right? You go, Amish, Mennonite, ultra-Orthodox, Jewish ultra-Orthodox, you know, Muslim, whatever. And you can tell just by the different cuts of beard, people are marking themselves out and saying, this is me. This is me. This is my culture. This is my beliefs. The kind of hats that people wear as well. You know, the different kinds of pillbox hats and so on and so forth. You can mark people out by their clothes, whether they go to their worship on a Friday, whether they go to their worship on a Saturday, or they worship on a Sunday. They're saying, they're putting down their markers. They said, this is us. This is our beliefs. This is our culture. This is our people. And when, always fascinating, again, just going through Jerusalem, there's this kind of marketplace, and it's called the souk, and they're very, very narrow alleyways going through the city. And you have, as you go down these alleyways, you pursue it, and you go down to the main mosque. So you've got some people who are heading down there on their way to the mosque. And they, you know, might be wearing like a long white gown, and they're preparing themselves going to worship. And you've got an ultra-Orthodox Jewish person who's going down the same little alleyway, but they're heading down to one of the synagogues, and they're wearing black kaftan and a black hat and their payas. They look so different. They're walking down the same bit of street, And there's such a historic animosity sometimes between these different groups of people. But they don't hide their identity. They don't sort of hide it away. They don't put their light under a bushel. They're not saying proudly walk down the street, but they don't make any apology for who they are. They stand out. They're distinctive. They stand out. And of course, there's lots of problems that revolve around all this. But you learn to be who you are, if you like, because you stand out. You just have to stand on your own two feet and just be who you are. If you go to Genesis chapter 1 for a moment, you see at the beginning of Genesis, you don't have to turn there because I know you know it pretty well, but God creates, doesn't he? And then he separates. He creates and then he separates. And he separates the day from the night. He separates the waters from the land, doesn't he? He separates these things. He's a distinguishing God. He distinguishes one thing from another. He delights to do that. So it's no surprise when we start reading a book like this and hearing Moses preaching to the people, one thing he's keen to do is to create a people and then separate those people out and make them distinctive, make them stand out from other people. His people are supposed to be different. You're supposed to be different. And I think that is something that gives us the clue. If we look in chapter 14, verse 1, the whole thing before, you know, there's so much talk about the laws and what it's all about. But it starts with, you are the sons of the Lord your God. It all starts with your identity. Who are you? Who are you? Do you know who you are? Do you know who you really are? Do you realize? People say that the sense of the Father is not very present in the Old Testament. God as Father is not very present in the Old Testament. Here it is. You are sons of the Lord your God. The Father is present. There is a sense of the Father, and we are the children of the living God. And when he goes on to say what they shall or shall not do, it's all linked to who you are. The reason you will do this or you won't do that is because of who you are. And that's quite important, isn't it? When you're asking somebody to make important decisions that are going to make them stand out from other people, that they're linking it to their sense of identity. If you do this, that is clean in the sight of God. If you do this, it's unclean in the sight of God. It's a funny word, isn't it? Clean, unclean. I mean, if there are some things that are nice to touch, right? There are just some things that are just quite repulsive. You know that experience of when you just come, you find something, it's like, it's usually on the bottom of your shoe, and it's kind of like, it repels you, doesn't it? Because it is fundamentally unclean to you. Everything that you've learned in your life tells you, you don't want to touch that. You don't want to be in contact with that. It produces a sense of revulsion. And here, God is instilling in this group of people a sense of real revulsion about some things. That is unclean. It's dirty. Don't touch it. And there are other things that are clean, that are good, that are healthy. We went had a cup of tea in a cafe in Oxford yesterday, a place called Brown's, and it's ridiculous. They sell you a cup of tea and they give you a little scone and a little tiny weenie cakes type things. And then they provide you this napkin that's about this big. And you need to have been working out a bit to pick it up. It's made of solid linen. It's kind of like you just go thump on your lap like this, you know. It's just so clean. It's so clean. And it just feels really, really nice. Makes you feel really special. He's setting out this distinction between that which is clean and unclean. And really getting people to... he's separating people, isn't he? He's separating a people out for himself. These people, you are my sons. You are my children. Verse 2, holy to the Lord your God. A clean people, a chosen people, a treasured possession. That's a wonderful verse, isn't it? A treasured possession. To consider what it means to be God's treasured possession. You don't keep your treasured possessions in the gutter, do you? That's not where you keep your treasured possessions. You find somewhere safe. You mark it out. You put somewhere safe. Often you put it on a mantelpiece. Put it somewhere conspicuous where it can be seen and appreciated. Your precious possessions. That's the Father speaking about you, his children. He delights in you. The delight of the Father for his children. Who he's washed and they're clean and they're set apart for his service. In schools, there's obviously a lot going on, isn't there, about evolution and descending from apes and stuff like that. And it's such a different mindset, isn't it, if you grow up saying that you are basically one generation on of a progress up from an ape. You know, so all those animal stuff, and then there's you, you're part of this animal kingdom and all the rest of it, as opposed to saying you are made in the image of God. You're made in the image of God. I'm not denying the fact that we're creations or anything like that, or that we're not, you know, have a lot of the similar features physically and so on and so forth, but there's something unique about human beings. What kind of identity are we instilling into people? What are we teaching people is their identity? Who are they really? Are they the children of the living God? Or are they animals? Are they animals? Oh, I like animals, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with animals, but there's a difference, isn't there? We can discern the difference between being an animal, if that's really what we are, just animals, or whether we're made in the image of God. It gives you a dignity, doesn't it? Sets you apart, makes you think about who you really are and who you're accountable to. Not to your nature and to your instincts, but to your Father, by your Father in heaven. What is the source of your identity? Who and how do you work out who you really are? Where do you get the markers from? Where do you get your instructions from? What tells you whether or you're not valuable, whether you're right or whether you're wrong? Where do you draw these things from? And you can see what's going on in the world. The shape of your body. When you look in the mirror and you look at yourself and you think, so I have had all my life certain images of a kind of a good-looking face put to me through the media, on films, in advertising. It's been going on every day. I'm 49 years old. I've had 49 years of conditioning and preparation to make an evaluation. So when I look in the mirror, I say, yes, my face fits, or no, my face doesn't fit. Yes, I was born with a gift to fit in, or no, I wasn't born with that face that's going to fit in. We do that, don't we? Our body shapes, how we look, what clothes we wear, the cars that we drive, all these sort of things. You know, every time you put your key in, and it's got, like, you know, as you know, with my car, it's got this little three-pointed star on there. The moment you pick that thing up in your hand, the whole idea is you think, right, all that advertising that manufacturer has pumped out through the media for generations, that sense of values that they have kind of projected out into the world. The moment you carry that key, the moment you put it, you are accessing all that. You are part of that value system. Is that where you get your identity from? From the clothes that you wear? If you've got a little Fred Perry here, does that kind of, you know, straight away, it's the golf club and the lunches and the aspirations and all these kind of things. Your identity, where do you get? So if I feel... Do I feel good about myself if I'm driving the right car, I'm wearing the right clothes, my face fits? Is that where I get my sense of who I am from? Because that changes all the time, doesn't it? And people lose their car or whatever, or can't afford the clothes, and their whole sense of themselves can collapse. They just end up in depression because their face doesn't fit and there's nothing. You see people literally, they're cutting their faces and remodeling and remodeling and remodeling their faces in the vain hope that somehow, they might eventually belong, that they might be affirmed, that they might be beautiful, they might be lovable. And all they need to know is that they are the children of the living God. And draw their strength and draw their sense of identity from that. What do we call it when you, I suppose this is what you were talking about yesterday. Is it dysfunctional worship syndrome? Is that right? Dysfunctional worship disorder. Otherwise known as idolatry, right? When you fit, you draw your sense of self, you worship and aspire to things that are just part of this world and they're passing. And they're, where is it? Worship the Lord. Worship the Lord, your Father, your God, and he will affirm you and set you apart and make you clean. We give off signals all the time, don't we? We're always giving off signals about who we are. So here's the question. How do people know that you belong to him? Do people know you belong to him? What are there other signals by the way you dress and what you drive, giving off all these signals? But is there a signal pulsating out from your life that says, this person is a child of the living God? Because sometimes that signal is pulsing out at a very, very low frequency. And there's a very, perhaps a more, a stronger frequency about the other identity markers that we've bought into, the lies that we've bought into, the vanities that we've entertained. But you know when you meet people, when the signal, I am a child of the living God, is pulsing out firm and strong, and it's a good thing. You can see here's a person who's grounded and settled as a Christian. That's a great thing, isn't it? And we must be aspiring to strengthen that signal. Because again, going back to this passage, it's all about identity. You are the sons of the Lord your God. Before we even get into the food stuff, it's all about who you are. If we know who we are, what we do and don't do then proceeds naturally from that reality. If the culture all around you is practicing X and the word of your father is saying do Y, then you have this moment of choice. Am I going to walk upright and be who I am? Am I going to, if that makes me stand out, here I am. Here I am. God has got a purpose for me to be distinctive, to stand out, a city on a hill, a light, and so on and so forth. We've heard all the verses. We've heard all the verses. So, okay, we're going to come to the food in a moment, but what are the markers? What marks you out as a Christian? So we've got the identity markers, some identity markers about food here in the Old Testament. Here, you and me. How about being baptized for a start, right? Doesn't that set you apart? It marks you out, doesn't it? The moment you're baptized, you're literally standing up and being marked, publicly marked out as a believer. When you come to a table like this and you accept the cup and you accept the bread, you are saying, I'm a partaker in the divine life. The Lord is my Father. He has saved me. That's part of what we're marking when we gather together for public worship. We put on our clothes. We go out in the morning. Where are you going? I'm going to worship the Lord. We stand out. We separate, don't we? Because people are going over to Aldi or whatever it is. And you're crossing in the other direction. When you pray, whether it's on your own or whether you meet with other people, and it's good to meet with other people to pray, isn't it? To lift your voices up and say, there's somebody who is speaking to them. And they don't mind who sees, they don't mind who hears, they're not doing it to show off, but they are doing what they're called to do, which is to communicate with their Father in heaven. And evangelism, talking about him, sets you apart. Nobody else is going to do evangelism, is there? Is anybody else in the world who's going to do evangelism but us, the children? Who's going to talk favorably about our Father and what he's done but us? And the love. How will they know that they're my disciples except for they love, the love that we show one for another? Because we're a family. We're a family. They're markers, aren't they? Markers for the Christian life. And in this passage here, we're seeing these markers. That's the point I'm trying to make. That in chapter 14, we're seeing these markers. And let me just say one thing before we move on. Who is determining what the marks are? Is it the people who are saying, I want to mark myself out as a believer by doing so and so? Or is it the Lord saying what the markers are? It's the Lord, isn't it? So I think my first point is God determines who you are and how that shows. God determines who you are And if you're his child, he also determines how that is to show, how that's to be revealed and made manifest in the world. So coming to the passage a little bit more on the text, what we basically have, a lot of these foodstuffs and the things that are mentioned there, these foods are just the common foods and practices of the Egyptians and the Canaanite world. You know, I did a bit of research on it at the time when all this was being written. You see, you and me, when we read through this, if you're given a choice between rock badger or lamb, I know you're an adventurous sort, Roy, but I would still imagine that you'd probably go for the lamb. Bones are a bit bigger. Somehow there's something about rock badger that just doesn't have the same attraction. Now, some of you perhaps been to the Far East, perhaps you've been to Hong Kong, perhaps you've been to the food in Hong Kong, you've seen the sort of thing that's on offer. There are scorpions, there are live eels, there's all sorts of stuff that, in all honesty, for us, it seems so alien. Beetles and all sorts of things that just normally speaking, you know, sea slugs. Literally, you're going, ugh. It can create a physical response to that sort of thing. And as we read through the list, if we're presented with the option between eating a bit of a bearded vulture, like it says there in verse 12, or beef, it's a no-brainer, isn't it, for us? But what we've forgotten is that we have been conditioned for generations of conditioning that make us say, that's clean, that's good, and that sounds just absolutely disgusting, and no thank you very much. We've been conditioned. We've been conditioned in no small part by the word of God, actually, for generations in this country that have sensitized us to certain things. And some other parts of the world, that just hasn't happened. In most to gather societies and things like that, literally any source of protein, they'll eat it. No problem at all. They won't even think about it. In fact, Bear Grylls did this experiment when he put a whole bunch of people on this island. I don't know if you saw any of it. Stuck all these people on an island. They were these British folk who'd been like working in offices, and they stuck them all in this island. And you just wanted them to just do some sensible things, you know, like, you know, build a platform, get a roof going, you know, build a fire, stuff. Oh, it was excruciating to watch. But by 3 or 4 weeks in, sometimes they went for 8, 9, 10 days without eating anything at all. And then they would capture like a little baby crocodile, a caiman. Honestly, before they went there, that was to them, would have been just disgusting. They would have never, ever eaten that food. But they're like it's the most delicious thing they've ever seen in their life. Because their circumstances have reconditioned them to see something as clean, which before they thought was unclean. And we've been conditioned. It's not long ago spaghetti was considered as like foreign food, and now most kids, they would probably starve to death without pine spaghetti, right? It's just part of our culture. These things change, don't they? And here, God is conditioning and starting to condition his people and get them used to practices and habits and settle them into things that will set them apart from these other people who, for whom eating these other things was not a problem at all. Having camel, there are parts of the world where eating camel is perfectly normal. In fact, it's a delicacy. And at the time when they were living, there were people around them. Pigs, for example, that's a classic example, isn't it? Pigs. We think of the Middle East and so on as a whole part of the world, they don't do pig. Right? But that's because Islam's been there for 1,400 years. But before that, there's lots of archaeological evidence. People kept pigs. It was a normal part of everybody's diet, just like it is in this part of the world. And God is separating these people from ordinary, normal practices that the people around them, and they'd grown up in Egypt, and that's what they'd eaten in Egypt, I'm sure. And he's saying, now you're coming a new way. Now you're doing a different thing. Because you're mine. Because you're mine. Calling people out after them. None of these things actually in and of themselves are bad necessarily. They're not terrible. Now, why? Why do the Muslims not eat pork? Why are they not eating pork? What's the significance of the fact that they teach that we shouldn't eat pork? The significance of it is they're making a statement. They're saying, they're taking it from texts like this, And what they're saying is, by not eating pork, they're saying, we, the Muslim people, are the children of the living God, right? Isn't that the statement they're making? The reason we're doing this is because we are making the claim that we are God's people. That's why they do it. And, you know, if you go to the amongst the Jewish community, this is the basis of what we call kosher, right? But today, the way kosher is practiced in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family bears little or no resemblance. That last verse there, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. You see that verse there? That verse has now become the kind of the backbone to the way Jewish practices are performed. So that you will have a situation in some Jewish homes where you have one kitchen cooking meat, another kitchen for cooking dairy. You cannot have a cup of tea with your beef because why? It's a possibility that the milk in your tea could in some way be related to the beef that you've just eaten, and you could be effectively cutting across the principle laid down, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Do you see that? So it's taken that point and it's extrapolated it out so massively so that now you'll have two separate kitchens, two sets of crockery. Why have they gone to such extremes to assert their obedience? What they're saying, what are they trying to say? It's we who are the children of the living God. That's what that statement's all about, trying to make an assertion and a claim about who they belong to, who they really are. People have said that this kosher laws, perhaps you've heard it, tell me, just sort of wink at me or something, if you've heard that these kosher laws have got something to do with health. It's a perfect health diet. One or two, okay. This has got nothing to do with, this is not like a perfect health diet laid out. I'm not saying it's not a healthy diet. If you eat these things, it's healthy food. But you can eat Japanese food, which certainly isn't kosher, and it's healthy food too. You can be healthy and eat all sorts of things. It's not about that kind of health. It's about who you are. That's the point. If it's about health, Mark chapter 7, verses 18 through 19, when Jesus just waves the whole idea that we are, that these foods have to remain unclean to you. Why did he give the vision? Why did God give the vision to Peter on the rooftop in Jaffa and tell us we can eat everything if the foods that we're now allowed to eat are poison and toxic and bad for your health? That's not the reason, is it? It's that there are new markers for your identity. New markers. And that's why the Seventh-day Adventists have got it wrong when they say you can't eat bacon and all those sort of things, because they're hanging on to the markers from that time. We're in a new phase, is a new covenant, and the markers are different. This is how you're to show you're the children of the living God. All these rules are about separation. Separating yourself from others, but more importantly, not just who you're separating yourself from, who are you separating yourself to? To whom do you belong? Oh, can you see how in a moment when we eat this meal, the significance of eating this cleanest of all clean meals, you are declaring yourself to be the children of the living God, eating from his table, aren't you? Eating those things which he has provided for you explicitly to eat. This bread, this cup, do this in remembrance of me. And people want to stand out. They're trying to make themselves an individual. But it's interesting, all these things that we're called to do, they don't so much make us stand out or look at us. They make us look at him. They make us look at him. Baptism, what does baptism speak about? The death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus. What does this table speak about? The death, the burial, the resurrection of Jesus. In our public worship, in our preaching, it's all the same. It points to him, doesn't it? Again and again and again. That's how we mark ourselves out, by constantly pointing to him, by lifting up the name of Jesus Christ. That's how people know you're his, by the way you love and speak about him. And they see what your identity is. They see your identity through that. They spent 400 years in Egypt, and they ate all these sort of things, and the people around them ate all these sort of things, and now God is reconditioning them. You all spend the majority of your lives, don't you, amongst people who are probably not Christians, you don't follow, don't know the Lord. You spent the majority of your life being exposed and conditioned to principles and values that come from the world. But the Word of God comes to us to condition us to a new thing, to set us apart, to make us to do something different, things that other people do not do. And when we do them, people say, those are the children of God. Those are the children of God. So there's this second point, really, which is that God gives us this new identity that we start to learn to express. And you get concerned about people, don't you, who start to slide back and they're not committed and they're not involved and they're not taking part. And because the sense of what you're seeing there is the sense of identity is slipping. That pulse is slowing and going quiet and not beating firmly and strongly and sending out the signal. I know who I am through Jesus Christ. Look, thirdly and finally, in verse 21, there's a reference there to the fact that if an animal has died, you're not to eat it, but you can give it to sojourners, and you can even sell it to a foreigner. So here is this culture that's been built up. But it's not to say that other people can't continue with their cultures. They're allowed to continue to be who they are. If that's okay for them, they can have that. If they want to buy that, that's fine. It's just not all right for you. It's not because this is better. This is different. You're different. We're not better than... Are you better than other people? Are you different to other people? Are you his treasured possession? That's the point, isn't it? We're not better. We're different. Would you take a non-Christian, a person who doesn't believe in the Lord Jesus, and baptize them? Would you think that's a good idea? Would you want them to sing Christian songs? Would you want them to stand up and preach the gospel to you? Would you want people who for whom these things are not natural to come up and take communion? Would you think that's appropriate that somebody who doesn't believe in Jesus to come up to this table and eat the bread and drink the wine? I don't. Because it would be as perverse as taking a kid straight from the matrix of its mother and boiling it in the milk which has been produced by nature to nurture that creature and to use it to cook it, which is a perverse thing to do, isn't it? It would be as perverse to ask an unbeliever to preach Christ and worship God. It's just not natural to them. It's not conducive to their consciences and so on and so forth. But it should be natural to us. It's for us. You know, this last verse about the young goat and the mother's milk, you know, it tells us something about God. It tells us something about God. God does not deal with his creatures that way. He doesn't bring something to life purely just to immediately kill it and seal it in its mother's milk. That is not our God. God is a creator. He loves life. And the purpose of that creature is that he should give it life. To kill that poor thing before it's even had a chance to have a life. To use that milk which is set apart for a purpose and use it in that way. It's wrong. It just does not speak. It doesn't speak of our God, because God, to God, life is precious. All these creatures, these clean creatures that we've been reading about here, when they're to be slaughtered, when they're to be killed, we've been told there that you can't let them just die naturally. You have to slaughter them. You have to kill them. And the way that they are to be killed at such time as they are to be killed, when they've had a life of their own, and it comes to the time when your life versus their life, you are more precious than those creatures, and he has given them for you, for your sustenance. But when they die, they're to be killed humanely. All the laws about how they should be killed are set in there so that they should not suffer. And the whole thing about the letting the blood drain out of their body, sorry to go into all the details, but is it to make sure that that creature is dead? You're not to eat a living creature. Again, in the Far East, you can go into a restaurant, there's a fish tank there, and there's a fish swimming around. And you fancy a bit of fish and you say that one and they hook it out, they will cut a scoop out of that fish and put the fish live back into the water and they'll serve you that bit of food. At the moment, there's a whole thing going on in America. They're trying to clamp down on it, like shellfish, like a lobster. You know that it's the tail that's a delicacy. They cut the end of the tail off. The lobster is still alive. They dress it and put it on the table. It's standing there like this, half, and its own part of its body that has just been severed from it is put next to it while people eat it in front of it. Octopuses are so intelligent. They're one of the most intelligent creatures in the oceans. They cut off their tentacles one by one, serve them while they sit there squirming. It's absolutely perverse eating. You know, when a thing, you need to kill it and kill it humanely. It is the God has made. And you should be offering that life back unto God with thanksgiving. That's why we give thanks at our table, don't we? Have we forgotten that often the food on our table has lived and died so that we might live? And when a person dies, and that's the first thing that this passage raises, the whole thing about mourning, when a person passes away and dies, we're not to treat that life with this in the way that the world does. We have got a comfort, we've got a hope, we've got a different aspiration for what God will do for that person and with that person in the coming days. We don't cut ourselves. We are people with hope because we know our God. And even these animals that are laid out in here, I'm drawing towards an end. As you look at the animals that are laid out here that we are to eat, that it says the people were to eat at that time. You know at the sacrifices, all these animals could be offered in sacrifice. And if you're going to offer these, and every creature offered in sacrifice could be offered, had to be perfect, without blemish and faultless, yes? And what does that produce in people is a great attentiveness to the health and well-being of the creatures. They should be healthy, they should be strong, they should be well-bred and so on. All these things tended to the welfare of the creatures. Just for the people to mark them out, but it also was for the good of the animals in question. Do you know who started the RSPCA? Some people will know. Who started the RSPCA? Who was the founding member and mover of the RSPCA? William Wilberforce. William Wilberforce. The same movement that was saying that the slaves should be set free, they are men. That same movement saying animals have rights as God's creatures to be protected. There was an act passed in Parliament, of which Wilberforce part. They started the RSPCA. By the way, people trying to dismantle some of the powers of the RSPCA at the moment. And what was interesting, as they did this, is they brought these organisations, Anglicans, Orthodox Jews, nonconformists, all met together and started the RSPCA because from their theology, from this book that they were reading, they believed that you shouldn't just treat an animal with a high hand. And if God cares about his creatures and expects us to show that care through our lives, how much more does he care about us? How much more does our lives and the lives of people, we hear horror stories about the way children are treated in some parts of the world. We should be making a difference. We should be different. If the death of his saints is precious, then how much more is the death of his own son precious? Of all the people of the world, who would be more precious than the Lord Jesus Christ as he comes into the world? All these animals, all our lives, are to be offered up to God as living sacrifices, given back to the Father who's given us all life. All these laws, I'm just saying, they're not just a random selection of laws. There's a revelation about the person of God, and there's a revelation about us embedded in these things. And yes, they have been superseded now, but is life still precious? Is all life still precious? Is it precious to you? Are the lives around you precious? We don't think lightly of the loss of any life. And that's why cruel sports and animal abuse and neglect should create a moral outrage for Christians. And yet seemingly, for some reason, we leave it to the world to protest about these sort of things. We believe that you shall not murder is still important, don't we? So these markers down here have got a logic, and they tell us about the Father's person. And if he is our Father, then something of his care and compassion should also be formed and shaped in us, the kind of people we are. It's not just a marker wearing a certain kind of hat. It's being a kind of person with a certain sort of attitude and approach to life. God centers our identity as his children in the sanctity of life. And that is something I believe should mark Christians out in the world. People care about the sanctity of life. So look, let me just summarize that. God determines who you are, and he shows you how to express it. God gives us a radical new identity, and we have to learn to show it. And this new identity is founded and centered in the person of our Father, our God. And to him, life is sacred. And that's something we should exhibit in our attitudes and approaches too. Per people set apart. So the death of the Lord Jesus, must be the most scandalous thing, the most terrible of things. And the cost and the price that he was prepared to come and give his life and give his blood in the way that he did. Because there is a time for laying down your life, isn't there? There's a time for giving up life. Just as like these animals, they had a place to give up their life for others, So when God comes, we see him doing the same as well, giving his life, for others. I'm going to ask Richard, please, and if you and Rob, if you come and give me a hand, please. We're going to serve this meal to you.